Welcome to the Smash Show, Bill.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And when were X-rays from space first discovered?
Well, there were X-rays discovered from the sun shortly after the Second World War. I think X-ray experiments with V-2 rockets date from the 40s, if not then from the 50s. But, of course, real astronomy begins when you can look at a large number of objects, and that means you can look at sources outside the solar system. And that first detection of X-rays from a source outside our own solar system came in a sounding rocket flight in 1962. The mission at that time was to detect X-rays from the moon. We knew that there were X-rays from the sun. Some of those should scatter and fluoresce and produce X-rays that bounce off the moon. And a group from the a company called American Science and Engineering flew a rocket experiment to look for those lunar X-rays. They didn't see the lunar X-rays. They weren't quite sensitive enough, but they did see two bright sources of X-rays. One is a source called SCOEX-1, the brightest source in Scorpius, and the brightest X-ray source in the sky. And the other was the diffuse background. They discovered the fact that the entire sky is glowing with X-rays.
And what was the first satellite that went up to discover, you know, or further pursue this idea of X-rays?
Well, of course, the folks that flew the first rocket experiment and discovered X-rays in 1962 from a celestial source wanted to extend their observations as quickly as possible. And to do that, a sounding rocket is a lovely way to do astronomy because it's quick and it's fast. You can build an experiment for even now a few $100,000, put it in a rocket, get your idea in the air within a year if you work quickly. That is wonderful, but for the fact that what goes up must come down. And if you send a rocket up that flies up to a few hundred kilometers altitude, it's going to spend only about 5 minutes above the atmosphere. That's the extent of your observation. If you want to do more detailed and longer studies of X-ray sources, you need to stay in space. And the way to do that is to get into orbit. And that's why satellite experiments were important. The first of those was called Uhuru. It's the Swahili word for freedom. And that was appropriate because when the Uhuru satellite built in the U.S. was launched from a platform off Kenya in 1970, the African launch site was honored with that name. Uhuru was the first satellite to survey the X-ray sky to find which were the bright sources and how were they distributed in the sky. And Uhuru succeeded in that task and in fact uncovered about 300 bright, which are the brightest X-ray sources in the sky.
Of course, having got a taste of finding those, astronomers presumably suspected there would be others, fainter, so presumably they developed better instruments and went on to discover further ones.
Yeah, there were a number of follow-up missions. The 1970s were a particularly active period. The next step took a true X-ray telescope in space, and that became available in, I think it was 1978 or 1979, with a satellite called HEO-2, which became much more famous with its working name, the Einstein Observatory. It was more sensitive by, I think, 3 orders of magnitude than anything done before. That's because of the sensitivity focusing optics give you. And it showed that X-rays come from a large set of astrophysical objects.
Then, of course, we went on and developed satellites like Exosat, didn't we?
Yeah, Exosat was a follow-up. It was the first European satellite which had focusing X-ray optics. I believe it was a 1983 launch, a few years after HEO. And Exosat was an interesting mission. It was an example of getting success from the jaws of defeat. There were two small X-ray telescopes on Exosat. And the original purpose of Exosat was to fly in a very high orbit with some maneuvering capability. And in that orbit, you could then look at the eclipses of X-ray sources by the moon. And because the orbit was so high, you were able to navigate the satellite around and pick between a large set of sources to create artificial lunar eclipses. That was the design, but that wasn't what the satellite ended up doing. And in fact, the X-ray telescopes, which were the high-tech part of the payload, were not what the satellite ended up doing, because unfortunately, out of four detectors on those telescopes, three failed in the first few months of operations. What we had then was a large area X-ray detector in a high orbit, which let it look continuously at X-ray sources. There's a big difference between an X-ray instrument on a high orbiting satellite and a low orbiting satellite. If you're skimming just above the surface of the Earth, like a low Earth satellite or the space shuttle, the Earth covers a lot of your sky and it tends to get in your way. Usually, if you are observing a source, it's going to be eclipsed once every 90 minutes, and it can be eclipsed for 30 or 40 minutes. If you're in a high orbit of 3 or 4 days, then you get long, continuous stretches of observation. So Exosat excelled in time variability studies. It saw eclipses, it saw dips, it saw other kinds of variability, all associated with the orbits in these binary X-ray sources. And it also saw more complex time variability phenomena. For instance, it discovered something called quasi-periodic oscillations, in which some of these X-ray sources don't emit a perfect tone like a bell, but instead a buzz. There is a preponderance of energy in some sources, it's around 6 cycles per second, which is telling us something important about the physics of the material falling onto the neutron star and the magnetic field that controls that flow. Well, one of the pushes in future missions is high-resolution spectroscopy. That is a push of missions like the XMM X-ray multi-mirror, a large area X-ray telescope to be flown by the European Space Agency in 99. AXAF, the American Advanced X-ray Astrophysics Facility for, I think it's 98 or 99. The large Russian Spectrum X-Gamma mission for 96. But where that spectroscopy is going to come into play is its full power will probably be seen in more diffuse hot sources like supernova remnants, the very hot but very tenuous, could be a very good vacuum by Earth standards, material that's left over after a supernova explodes.
Mm. So, the push towards these new satellites like XF, what perhaps one of the last large satellites. What do you expect to come out of such new missions?
Well, these are different sorts of missions with slightly different objectives. In AXAF, the objective is to make the best, that is, the sharpest X-ray telescope that you can imagine. And with AXAF, that means that we'll be getting down, I think, the next best X-ray telescope to date, ROSET, has something like 10 or 20 arcsecond resolution. With AXAF, that'll go to half an arcsecond, so it's as good as the best telescopes from the ground. That, combined with a fairly large telescope, means that we can see faint objects, the faintest that have ever been seen. A sharp telescope, sharply focused telescope, lets you distinguish faint objects from background. And that means we can, with AXAF, hope to completely resolve the X-ray background, the diffuse glow around the sky that I mentioned earlier. We think that it comes from active galactic nuclei, that is, processes at the center of galaxies like quasars and radio galaxies, and active galactic nuclei at very large distances. Though very bright, these sources are faint to see them. To break up this background into its individual pieces, you need a very sensitive telescope. That's AXAF.
Okay. Just another parallel move, of course. While these huge telescopes are being developed, there are smaller missions being proposed. Why have we got these two levels of work going on? One, the huge mega billion-dollar projects, and the other one, the smaller, hundreds of million dollar projects?
Because there's important things to be done with both, is the simple answer. There's certain things that you just can't do without big instruments. That's where the XFs and the XMMs come into play. These instruments are so big and so costly that a nation, even as prosperous as the U.S., can fly one every 10 or every 20 years in any particular field like X-ray astronomy. How do you keep the field alive if you're only flying a mission every 10 or 20 years? How do you train new students and new scientists, the tools of the trade? Who's going to know how to build X-ray instruments 10 years from now when you want to fly the next AXF-class mission? Something's got to come in between to fill the gap and to fill it scientifically. And that's why one needs small missions. Because at the same time that our dreams of what can be done with a very large mission have taken us to Hubble and CERTIF and AXF-sized missions, our especially electronic technologies have made what you can do in a small satellite more and more capable. You can do specialized spectroscopy missions. You can take ideas which are new and fly them quickly. And it's often the case that a brand new technology, a small but modern satellite that incorporates a new technology, might be able to do science, make measurements that 10 years ago would have taken something much bigger. That was the case of our small Alexa satellite at Los Alamos, for instance. And to develop a small satellite with a new look at the entire X-ray sky is the reason that I'm here in Australia visiting the University of Melbourne.
Mm. So what exact proposal are you putting forward here?
What we'd like to do is to build an X-ray all-sky monitor. That is an X-ray telescope that looks at the whole sky at a time. I've mentioned the importance of time variability, and of course, ideally you'd like to look at every source in the sky and watch its variation on every time scale, from seconds to days to months to years, and make a continuous record of all these variable objects and be able to do detailed studies on each of them. That's been done before. That work started with a Los Alamos project called VELA that flew in 1969. It's continuing with a couple state-of-the-art instruments, one called MOXIE, being built in the U.S., another, an X-ray all-sky monitor for the X-ray Timing Explorer satellite to be flown, I think, within the next year and a half by the U.S. But these instruments have reached a fundamental limit. I talked about the fundamental limit of sensitivity of a non-focusing telescope before. There was a revolution that happened when the Einstein Observatory came into play. We'd like to have a similar revolution in measurements that look at the whole sky at once. To do that, you need an X-ray telescope that looks at the entire sky. Kind of X-ray telescopes that have been flown so far can't do that. They have limited fields of view, a degree, a couple degrees at best. To look at the whole sky at once, you need a new kind of optic. And the place to turn for such an optic is the nature. Or if not nature, at least the table on your favorite Chinese restaurant. If you look at a prawn or a lobster and look at how its eye is built, it's built of a number of square tubes with mirrors on the inside. And that kind of object, a lobster eye focusing telescope, can also be built in the X-ray domain. And that kind of satellite could give you the kind of field of view that it takes to look at the whole sky at once.
So it's sort of like a compound eye.
It is, in a sense, a compound eye. It's a compound telescope with, in fact, a single detector. And it does what other telescopes do. It takes light from a large area on the surface of the telescope and focuses it to a small point on a detector.
So the satellite will look in all directions, but won't the Earth get in the way, and the Moon and the Sun?
Well, in a low Earth orbit, the Earth covers about 30% of the sky. But fortunately, you go around it. So if a source is covered now, it probably won't be covered 45 minutes later. Sometime during the 90-minute orbital period of a satellite in low Earth orbit, you see the whole sky. We take advantage of that fact. The Moon is not a particularly bright source in the X-rays. It's not going to it will not cause backgrounds, and it doesn't cover a significant part of the sky. The Sun is a bright source of X-rays, and there'll be a dead area in some small part of the sky surrounding the Sun, where we have to reject what's coming at us so that we're not overwhelmed by a fairly bright X-ray flux from our nearest star.
But of course, as the Earth takes us around the Sun, we'll get to see what's on the other side of the Sun eventually, won't we?
Exactly. Just wait a month and the Sun has moved significantly across the sky.
And how would this project be financed, and how would the work on it to be divided up.
Well, we're at the very earliest stages of this project, one of the fun stages, which is the conceptual design. I and folks at the Melbourne Uni, Keith Nugent and people in his optics group, have been putting our heads together to ask ourselves, can the optics, the lobster eye design that's been developed in large part here in Australia at Melbourne University, can it be applied to an X-ray astronomy satellite? I've been here for 6 months as a visiting fellow at University of Melbourne. We've studied this question, and the answer is yes. It looks like quite an attractive idea. So now comes the harder part. How do we translate that idea to reality? And that's where we need to begin writing proposals, getting our ideas down as compellingly, as soundly, and as soundly as possible, and approaching funding agencies. In the United States, there are regular opportunities to propose for a program called Small Explorer. It's a program of regular launches of small astronomical and other scientific satellites. And we think we have a strong case to be made offering up such a satellite. We want to make this an international proposal. And in particular, I think Australia has something important to offer in the way of the optics. And it would be appropriate for Australia to contribute, say, a 10% share of the project. And that's the objective of my collaborators here, is to see if they can develop proposals to make that sort of support possible. And we would also be proposing approaching other potential partners in the UK, perhaps in Germany, perhaps in Denmark, to see if they're interested in roles in this project.
It makes the point that all projects these days, or pretty well all projects, are international. And the costs, the development work, the scientific ideas, and the results are shared amongst all the participants.
Exactly. It's an international field, and of course the internet makes it every year even more so. These are fairly expensive projects, cheap by space standards, but a small satellite, we would be looking for something in the budget range of, say, 40 million Australian. So it helps to help simply financially to get contributions from other countries as well. NASA has a very clear policy that the data that is produced in their astronomical missions is public. We, if we're so lucky to be the principal investigator team flying such a satellite, we have a little bit of quiet time to analyze the data ourselves and do what we can in publishing it. But that there is a clock ticking. That's NASA policy. Data are only owned by the people who built the satellite for 1 year after the data are received to the ground. After that time, data from all NASA scientific missions go into public archives, and they're available to astronomers worldwide.
So if you don't get your research paper written up and so on, someone can beat you to it.
Exactly. And that is a good reason to get to it and do what you promised to do and do it quickly.
So you don't sort of sit on the data for 10 years and say, ha, it's mine. And
it is absolutely no longer allowed.
Well, Bill, I certainly hope that your projects, there are many of them, go well. And we hope that Spectrum gets up and gives you a good supply of data.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us tonight on The Space Show.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.